Thanks. Thanks for inviting me. Thanks for the introduction. So I will talk a bit about Mirage OS and unikernels, and I will mainly focus on the deployment side, which is basically what we at Robur, where I work, have been focusing on since 5 years or so. So where do we go? So first of all, the contents is a bit about Mirage OS, then how to actually run it, how to move from a research project, which Mirage OS was initially, to actually a production system, which is not that easy. Then a bit about developer experience that has recently or is still in progress to improve. And then a bit about what is available, what can you actually run by now. So first of all, the idea was to write, well, this was back in the days when Xen was a big thing. Some people at Xen servers, so the people writing Xen code and the hypervisor, they thought, oh, what is actually the minimal viable system that we can run on such a Xen hypervisor? And then, since they already had written some OCaml code, they wrote some more OCaml code, just the bits and pieces needed for running a virtual machine on top of Xen. So it was not a full Linux or something like that, but it was really only OCaml code. And only OCaml means OCaml has a C runtime, so it has a garbage collector or memory manager and so on. So it's some bits of C that are still around that we haven't removed yet. Also, back in the days, they also used libc, so a C standard library. Back then, they used a system called, or a library called diodlibc from Felix from Leitner, which is a very small libc compared to GNU libc and so on. That was the initial idea back then. So, I mean, obviously, it has evolved, and by now we don't use a libc because we don't need libc. We have the three or four functions that we need in C, like memcopy, memcompare, and so on. We have that directly integrated, but we don't have a full implementation of a libc. The idea is really on the left side. You can see what a conventional contemporary OS like Linux or so is composed of. In the dark brown at the bottom, you see the kernel. What the kernel provides as services, like a network stack, file systems, some kernel threading, some user process management, scheduling, and so on. And then on top of that, you also have in the user space, you have the programming language runtime, like the OCaml runtime, or the Java runtime, or the Python runtime, or whatever. Then you have the application binary, which is the actual application that you care about. And then you also have some configuration files spread over your file system on your disk, which always have the wrong permissions and all that messy stuff, and are in the wrong directory and have the wrong syntax. So the idea with Mirage OS is to condense that a bit down and actually only have the runtime, which is here called the Mirage runtime, which is actually the OCaml runtime and some further bits. And then the application code on top of it. So what does that mean? Well, we have a network stack in Mirage OS, which is written in OCaml, but it's just an OCaml library. So it doesn't come from the host system. So it is a library that is developed also in OCaml, where we have memory safety, where we have some security functionality, where we are not as vulnerable as a C implementation thereof. We also have a file system, but not every unikernel or every service needs a file system. Because why would, for example, your DNS server need a file system? Why would your web server need a file system? And so on. Talking about user processes, well, we don't have user management and we don't have processes. We basically only have one process, and then we defer to whatever OCaml provides in order to schedule lightweight threads or to schedule tasks. But we don't have processes and process ID and virtual address ranges and all these stuff that you have in a normal Unix environment. So it's much, much smaller. Here's a comparison of one of the earlier unikernels that I co-developed, which was a web server that just served a static page. And on the right hand, you can see what a Linux virtual machine with Apache and so on, what that means. It is in binary size roughly 200 megabytes, and it consists of 2.5 million lines of code, mostly C code. On the left-hand side, we have the Mirage unikernel. Back then, it was roughly 8 megabytes in size and 100,000 lines of code. This includes the OCaml runtime. This includes the 30,000 lines of code that the OCaml runtime is. But nevertheless, it's a factor of 25 that the code is smaller. So in the right-hand side, you have a general-purpose operating system, and you use only a tiny bit of functionality. But nevertheless, you have 2.5 million lines of code that you need to care about. And if there is a security issue in one of these lines of code, you likely need to update, because it might be exploitable. Or at least you have to think about, oh, is this code path vulnerable and exploitable, and can you get there somewhere? So that is a basic idea of MirageOS. MirageOS runs as a virtual machine, as you can see here on the left. So you have the host system, and then you have a very small so-called tender, or a very small process on the host system that provides you with an API for the unikernel. And that very small API that we have here, these are actually 7 different system calls or hypercalls. In the middle, we have a normal QEMU-based virtualization thing, where you have the host system and you have the virtual machine, and you have a rather broad amount of system calls that the virtual machine can call from the host. So the API is rather big in that, but compared for the last thing, where you have containers like Docker or whatever, you have the host system and the API, the amount of API calls that you can do, the amount of system calls is very big. So here we have around 7. Here we may have whatever, maybe 50. And here we have, I think, 400 right now. So the idea is to limit the API that you have access to in your unikernel. That also means you have more security, or you need to secure less system calls. Because if you only have a read and write on the network interface, you only need to take care about these 2 system calls to be safe and secure. Whereas if you have a big interface, you always need to figure out whether all of the system calls are good. And in the container, well, there you have the whole host system kernel basically in there, and it's very hard to get it secure. So the idea in a nutshell is we have a tiny virtual machine. We have the complexity reduced. We also have reduced the legacy, so we don't have stuff like a floppy disk driver or whatever old hardware device drivers that you may have in a Linux kernel. We don't have it. We only have a network device driver and a block device driver. That's all we need. We only need network and block. We also have output to the standard, to the console, but we don't read input from the console, for example. We don't need that interaction. The size is reduced, and also the attack surface is reduced. By having a very small size, you also have a very small attack surface. We also have fewer attack vectors, since most of the code is written in OCaml, which is memory safe, so we don't have any memory issues in the code, which means that spatial and temporal memory safety issues are not a thing in MirageOS. That is the entire thing. So the next topic is about how to deploy MirageOS unikernels. And could you show your hands if you know something about IP addresses and network interfaces? That's good. Who knows something about firewalls? That's great. What about bridge interfaces? Cool. We're getting there. Network bases. So here you can see a laptop, which has a wireless network interface and is connected to the wild internet. On there, we would like to run some virtual machines. And these virtual machines may as well want to have access to the internet. So what do we need here? The virtual machines, as I described earlier, they don't have direct access to the host system network interface and not to the host system network stack. So we need some sort of interface to have their Ethernet frames or have their network packets that are then routed via the laptop to the internet. What we use there is so-called, well, it's actually virtual network adapters. These are so-called TUP interfaces in Linux and Unix. And then at the same time, we use virtual switches. So switches are these old thingies where you put cables in, and we basically stick cables into these virtual Ethernet interfaces to the virtual switches, and then we have connections. All we need on the laptop is some firewalling, so and some routing, so to actually get the packets from the virtual machine up into the internet and get packets from the internet back here. We will use some IP address range, and the laptop will act as a router and firewall, as I mentioned earlier. And virtual machines will use a separate network or separate IP addresses on that. How do you deploy Mirage as unikernels? And for that, I need to switch a bit into another web interface that is running on the local machine. This is also unikernel. I will come back to that later. It's called Mollymog. It's here in order to deploy unikernels. So we will deploy our first unikernel. That will be a Hello World unikernel. So we just set a name, hello, and we say, here's a virtual machine image. It's actually the hello key.hvt. And then we will say restart on failure, and then we say deploy. And now actually we see here another unikernel, well, the first unikernel that we can view. And here it is deployed now. So we didn't need to set up anything fancy, but we basically just deployed it. And now it's you can see here the console output, which is saying hello world four times and then starting again and starting over. It's not very exciting, this unikernel.
Does it matter that that's a unikernel? I mean, could it be any OS image, no? Or no?
What do you mean?
Well, this is a hypervisor, no?
Yes, this is a hypervisor. This is just a virtual machine.
Yeah.
So it could be anything.
Right, okay.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But we are the web interface. We uploaded the image, so the binary, the application, the image of the virtual machine, which was 2 megabytes in size, and that is just the virtual machine to print Hello World. And now there are some interesting bits and pieces up here, buttons, especially the update button, I think is very interesting. So what does update mean? So in deployment and in life cycle of applications, at some point, as I mentioned earlier, you may encounter there are security issues in some of the programs, or there are performance improvements in some other areas of the thing. And now such a unikernel, we can take a look. We're going back and we view it here on our reproducible build infrastructure. And here we actually have a file that is just a text file. So that includes all of the OPAM packages that are included in this binary, so that that the unikernel uses. And that is actually quite a list, or it's, I would say, 50 different libraries or so that are already used by that simple Hello World unikernel. So what does update do? Update takes a look into our reproducible build infrastructure. So we build on a daily basis, we build a huge set of unikernels. And then whenever you have a unikernel deployed from that reproducible build infrastructure, you can actually say, oh, I want to update to the latest version of that very same unikernel. And what you see here is on the left side, you see the current build where you have a name and the build time that was built in December last year. And here on the right-hand side, you have the same information about the latest build. The latest build was built, well, yes, today at 6 in the morning. that is automated every day. Then the binary size changed a bit, so it became a bit bigger. But what is more interesting is here the so-called version differences. So we have some open packages that have been in the current build on the left side, so to say, that have been, for example, OCaml in version 4.14.2. And now in the latest build, it's 4.14.3. That is very interesting because now we can actually see what has changed in the source of the unikernel that we would like to update to, or that we are able to update to. Down here we see also some further differences. Yes, but the interesting piece here is actually OCaml 4.14.3 was released, I think, 3 weeks ago, and OCaml is at version 5. If you don't know, version 5 was released 3 or 4 years ago, and it has multi-core and effects and so on. But 4.14 is still a maintained version, and 4.14.3 was released 3 weeks ago because there was a big security issue in the OCaml runtime, and there was a patch release for that. So actually, we want to run a unikernel without security issues, potential security issues. So we can actually update it. So you can here click to upgrade to latest. Now it asks me whether it should perform some liveness checks or whether it should update the configuration, but we don't want to do that. I just click on proceed to update. So what is now happening is that Molimorg, the web interface, actually downloads the new version of the unikernel and then deploys it. And eventually we will see something. Are there any questions so far? I will try the other button. Now we have at least updating. Now we have year update successful. Now we see hello again here, and now we also, we don't see much of the difference in behavior because obviously it's still the hello world unikernel and we still see hello world. And now if I click update, we see that, oh, there's actually no update available. Cool, that was a hello world unikernel. That's not very interesting. So we'll deploy another unikernel called website. I will give it a bit more of memory. Add a network interface. I will just type in service here. Then some arguments. Well, maybe a remote Git repository. So I'm typing in the repository that is my personal blog. Okay, and now a unikernel binary image, and here I will take another one, which is called unipy.hvt, and then I will click deploy. And unipy is a unikernel which has an HTTP stack, so it is an HTTP server that serves pages, and it also has a Git implementation inside of it. And the Git implementation goes out, fetches the Git repository that I just provided on command line, clones it into memory, and then starts serving from memory. So now we have a website here. Okay, well, I will access http website.mirage. And here I'll see the website. So earlier I talked a bit about network IP addresses and so on, and what you see here now, we didn't use any IP addresses because actually the deployment process here with Mirage AS, Molimorg, and another unikernel called DNSvisor is in the shape that we don't need to manually specify any IP addresses or so. But it actually uses the HTTP, which is a standard protocol, which distributes the IP address, and then also it registers the name that we selected, which in this case was a website. It registers that that name website and makes it accessible, so we can access it via website.mirage. So some more features about Mollymog, which is we have here user management in there. And inside of the user management, we also have resource policies. So Mollymog is able to talk to multiple different hosts that can run unikernels. And Mollymog itself can then, or Mollymog itself has these so-called policies where you can specify how many unikernels are there, how much memory is the user allowed to use. What are the network bridges, so the network interfaces that the user is allowed to use for all of their unikernels, and how much block space is the user allowed to use. And that all is checked dynamically, so you can't deploy more unikernels than specified here. That means Mollymog, together with the server process called Albatross, is able to have multiple tenants on the same host. So it's basically a hosting infrastructure. Other hosting infrastructures would be Kubernetes or Amazon EC2 or so, or Fly.io or whatever. And here you can specify it. Well, that is targeted for unikernels first and foremost, but we can also deploy other virtual machines on there. And you can really specify these resources that you have, so you don't need to overcommit your memory and so on. Also, unikernel doesn't, unikernel has a static memory allocation, so it doesn't request more memory during its lifetime, but it first gets whatever, 32 megabytes, and then it lives with that. This is basically what Mollymog provides to us right now. Console output, updates, lifetime, life cycle management. Yeah.
Does it please provide persistent storage, or is this ephemeral?
Mollymog itself uses persistent storage, for example, for the user database. Also, it provides the ability to create block devices called volumes here. Block devices, and there you can create more block devices on the physical host. You can back them up. You can download them. You can upload data to them, and these can then be used by the different unikernels. And that has Mollymog itself has been developed over the last year, mainly by Pixie Dust and myself, based on a grant from the European Union from NGI. NGI is the project's next generation internet. Statistics soon we will as well, so we have bits and pieces in place, but it's not yet final. We will have statistics like counters and so on directly integrated there, and then use Grafana for displaying that. So you will be able to just deploy your unikernel, and you will get then a Grafana dashboard from both the unikernel, which may report some counters and some metrics, but also from the host system that knows a bit about the resource usage, the network data that was coming in, going out, the amount of CPU usage, and so on. And that will all be integrated and be part of that. As I mentioned, Mollymog and Albatross together. Albatross is the Unix daemons that are running on the host on the laptop, basically. And Mollymog, as a unikernel, communicates with these processes via authenticated and encrypted channels. They provide lifecycle management, statistics collection. They integrate into the reproducible build database, as you have seen with the update, and we can have resource policies and multi-tenant hosts. Now I'm switching back to the agenda of the talk, because we have processed quite far so far, about research code. So we started, as I mentioned, this whole Midrasho has started as a research project as well. The focus was to publish papers, as it is usual in research code. So what do you do to publish papers? Well, you hard code all the configuration into the source code, because nobody cares about that. And then if it works on my machine for some hours, that's fine, publish. If it works long enough that you can conduct some benchmarks, that's great. I was able to collect all the benchmarks. It's good. Nowadays, maybe at some point you do this artifact evaluation and you then provide also some Docker image or whatever for that. Eventually also, especially if you say, oh, I have a new network stack, you use some stress testing utilities and you really conducted benchmarks. But usually only on your host or on your lab's host also. So on the wild internet, there's actually a lot of different TCP/IP traffic. So a lot of different stuff coming around, which is from broken tools, from broken implementations. And yeah, you have to be a bit more careful in your applications to not hit any resource leakages, like memory leakage, just because some random TCP/IP stack does not behave as the standard or as the standard commands. If you're lucky with, especially with network protocol implementation, some people have applied fast testing and found some issues and fixed them so it will crash less often. In production, well, how do you actually deploy is the first question. Especially if it is a complete different paradigm. So we are not a container, we are not a full virtual machine. So deploying it with Proxmox or any full virtual machine utility or with Kubernetes is actually quite painful. Especially with the fact that Kubernetes is actually a million lines of Python code that you run on your hypervisor. So yeah, well, you may actually run into issues there as well. Then how do you deliver security? And the story for security inside of these things for me is at least reproducible builds. So what does that mean? That means we have infrastructure in place where we run these daily builds of unikernels. And they record which OPAM packages, which host system packages were installed on that build system. So what influenced the build is all recorded in there. And not only by name, but also by URL of the tarball and the checksums of the tarballs, or Git commits if it is a Git repository. And the goal of reproducible builds is you get that piece of information, which packages, which host system packages, which environment variables were turned to what. And then you should be able to bit by bit reproduce the very same binary as we did. So you don't need to rely on us running this reproducible build setup, or you don't need to trust us, but you can actually reproduce it. And I mean, bit by bit identical is usually a bit tricky if you have software that records timestamps or whatever in there during their build process. But it actually works. We have that infrastructure in place since 6 or 7 years. And we found several issues in OCaml packages, in OPAM packages, but we fixed all of them that we encountered. Then also for deployment, what is crucial, so now you have this nice unikernel with reproducible builds and so on. Now you want to deploy it, and if it is a more complex service like a calendar server or so, you want to embed some configuration somewhere. And all the configuration we embed, in contrast to the research project, we put the configuration in as boot parameters, or we specify as boot parameter, so as command line argument, where the Git repository with the configuration is, or how to get the configuration. Well, we have a block device where the configuration is stored. But that is very different from the research project approach, where basically you hard code all the configuration in the source code. Yeah, and the security is basically reproducible build infrastructure, and there we can see that For example, we have not a vulnerable OCaml runtime. Then operations, yeah, statistics. I mean, for me at least, the statistics gathering is very crucial, because there I see if I run 10 different unicorns, some do DNS, so some easy work, some are web service, I see where which ones actually leak memory, and then I can figure out, oh, which open packages should I read? Should I read more that may leak memory? Now I have a small animated GIF that I recorded some time ago, which is the Mirage Hello World that we saw previously, and the code changed over the years. So initially when I started, the code was basically like that. Mirage is in the current state, a two-stage program. So on the left side, we have a file called config.ml that specifies some bits and pieces, and then we have a file called unicornl.ml that specifies some other pieces. This is from 2016, the version, and now I recorded myself editing the both files for additional versions, and how the the idea is that you can see how basically the ecosystem itself, how it evolved over time. So here in 2017, I think the only change was that we moved from os.time.sleep_ns to time.sleep. Yeah. And then, yeah, we use more packages and so on. And I think, so my involvement with Mirage OS started roughly in 2015, I think. Well, maybe 2014 already. And as you have, if you have attended Xavier's talk this morning, you can see here on the right-hand side also that it is a piece of functorized code. So we have a module that takes some other modules as input. And over time, you see right now the console device or the console stuff was removed. So we actually managed to remove some complexity, or we managed to remove some code and use some other ways in order to do the same thing. Yes, but I'm not patient enough to wait for it. It's also online, you can watch it yourself. So as you were saying, back in 2019, I actually gave a tutorial at BobConf, and there we had a lot of functors inside of the code base. Like a unicornl was functorized over everything, over the network device, over the clock, over the time, over the random number generator, and so on. But I always wondered, are they actually useful? Well, the question is, I mean, you can always add more abstraction onto a system, and you will end up with a system that is more abstract. But at some point, the question is, are they really useful? Because adding functors actually also gives you some penalty, because the developer tooling is, the editor tooling is not perfect for functors. So sometimes you don't find the definition, or you actually don't know what the functor will be instantiated with at runtime. And it is actual complexity to understand the code. And I heard once from Daniel Binsley that a functor is only useful if you instantiate the same thing with two different types. So for example, if you have a set of string and a set of integers in the same application at runtime, then it's useful to have a functor. But for network device, for clock, for time, for a random number generator, I actually want to reason only about having a single thing thereof at runtime. Because having two different clocks inside of a unicornl, you could think about that that you can do it, but does it make sense? I don't think so. The other thing was, or still is, the developer experience of having a two-stage compilation path with Mirage Configure that generates code and make. And again, the editor tooling and the error reporting is pretty bad. We also had quite some complexity for a feature that was barely used, like being able to set command line arguments at development time, at configuration time, and at runtime, at boot up time. So now, going forward, Mirage has an OCaml 5, where we have multi-core and effects. You likely have attended the tutorial earlier these days. Romain, a co-worker of mine, he developed MIU, a scheduler for OCaml 5. And also, he developed mkernel and mnet, which replaces actually the Mirage tool, and also a tool called OpenMonorepo. So now, this new approach to develop unikernels takes into account the pain points of developer experience. There are no further two-stage builds. There are no unnecessary functors. There's no code generated. And it turns out the binaries are smaller. I don't understand why, but they are. There's a tutorial online. And so far, while OCaml 5 is multi-core ready, this is only single CPU for now. We are still working on getting Solo 5, which is the tender, so this small thing that runs in the host system, that still only knows about a single CPU. The Hello World, you can read that up later, I think. I will jump to available unikernels. Back from static websites, as you have seen previously, that fork, that do a Git clone of Git repository and just serve the contents of the Git repository over different DNS servers that even provide you with Let's Encrypt certificates and so on, over DNS Visor, which hands out IP addresses and also communicates with DNS, Kaldorf server, VPN implementations, soon also WireGuard. We have a firewall, we have a snippet paste unikernel, TLS proxies, reverse TLS proxies. We also have a mirror of the OPEM repository, including the archives. So we have we use a tar implementation for that. So we have a block device with one tar file basically, but we only append to, and we have all the OPEM archives on there. Molimog, you have seen, it's also a unikernel. To conclude, Mirage OS, we have tiny virtual machines, we have security, supply chain security, reproducible builds, so we know what all ended up in the unikernel. We have a user interface with Molimog that you can use your web browser in order to maintain your different fleets of unikernels at different sites. We also, what I didn't show, we will soon have a scaling up, scaling down of unikernels, of the same unikernel, distributing load. It's all open source projects, very permissively licensed. You can join us at mirageos.org. And for robo.coop, the workers collective that I'm working with other people on these things, you can donate money or sponsor us via GitHub. We also receive a lot of money from NGI projects handed out by the European Union. So thank you for the European taxpayers for giving us the money to work on that. We also received money from Prototype Fund, which is a German government funding agency, and also from Taridis, which is OCaml consulting company, I think. I don't know. How do you describe Taridis?
It's perfect.
Perfect. Okay. Thank you for listening. I'm happy to take any questions.
So of the technology and like the knowledge or the experience that you gain, what can be transferred to other language ecosystems?
From my...
So say I have a Haskell application.
Yes.
I want to run that in a unikernel.
Yes.
for Haskell, there's also a unikernel framework. I forgot its name, but it's there. And I think what is crucial, especially for deployment and if you want to bring it to industry, is this whole have a supply chain of know how to build reproducible images, what ended up in the image, in order to also be able to do an inventory of your running virtual machines. So to do an inventory of knowing, oh, I need to update that. So the transfer, I think, is if you want to develop applications and so on, and also do it in a non-standard way, so not a Docker container or whatever, you need to think about how to get the configuration in some way. And hard coding the configuration inside of a unikernel, I think, is not feasible, because it depends on whom you target. But if you target a lot of people, these won't be people who want to write OCaml code or Haskell code in order to run their own unikernels.
Okay.
Does that make sense?
Yeah.
At the moment, these unikernels have a target of web applications. Would it also be possible to do something like this on microcontrollers, because these resources are quite low, right? I'm quite impressed by what I see.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. There have been also ports previously to the ESP32 microcontroller for Mirage OS. There have been ports for QB boards and smaller ARM devices of Mirage OS. And, I mean, my focus is network and security protocols mostly. And there, for example, we have DNS servers and DNS resolvers. And these are not really connected to web. So, yeah.
And so how would you do I/O on such a device? You said you have block device. I guess it would be just an extension of that?
Yes, block device, and on the ESP32, we use the network interface implementation. So we ran bare metal, or we run bare metal on that, and then we just use the C code that provides the driver, and we just embed the C code into OCaml.
Cool, thanks.
Thanks a lot. I totally agree for the functor part. It's very complicated to configure everything using functors. I have a question. Do you recommend to use Mirage OS to, for example, let's imagine that I want to write a web application and I decide that every service should be a different unikernel, or do you think it's too much complicated for regular applications?
I think it makes a lot of sense for regular applications. Also, you can, I mean, if your API boundary is nice, so you can put shared code into one open package. Mm-hmm. Like, for example, there's an open package that provides you with syslog, so you can actually all your logs and your console output will end up at a syslog server. And so if you have these tiny bits and pieces that are in different open packages, you can reuse them in a lot of unikernels, and actually the code that each individual unikernel is doing and that is not part of a library is very small.
Cool.
And I think it makes sense to have one unikernel when you have, for example, security boundaries. So for that. So I wouldn't spawn a unikernel for each API endpoint of web service.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Do you have tooling for debugging and profiling the applications?
Yes.
Like if they crash, do you
Yes.
patch dumps or something?
Yes. So we have we can core dump and then open the dump in LLDB or GDB. We have with Solo 5, we can also directly connect the GDB and can debug it,
yeah,
as you can debug in GDB OCaml code, which is not perfect, but we can do it. For profiling, there's also MemTrice, which is a statistical memory profiler developed for OCaml and the OCaml runtime, and that is also part of, so you also can have it in unikernel, and then what you get is basically a trace file that you can open with whatever Chrome trace or some custom tooling from Jane Street that they developed for that trace format. And that also was very useful, at least for me, to figure out some memory leaks that I discovered also in the TCP/IP stack when I ran it on the wild internet, not only for an hour, but for weeks, months, years.
All right. Thank you, Hannes.